Now, to a very poignant but vivid cross-cultural life story out of India via the British Raj to London fame of a sort, which has now been captured as something of a grand narrative of the last century. It's the story of Queen Victoria's goddaughter who turned her outsider status towards revolutionary behaviour, fighting for female suffrage. She put herself in the front line. She was fearless. She bankrolled others. It became her raison d'etre. In fact, at the peak of her activism, and much to the surprise of her set, the British royal family, Hampton Court Palace was closed to visitors for fear of attacks from fellow suffragettes. It was a far cry from the very spoilt royal life the Indian princess was born into in Britain, but she was, as you'll hear, fundamentally, and despite her wealth, a displaced person. Anita Anand is a BBC journalist and the presenter of Any Answers on BBC Radio 4. Her book is titled Sophia, Princess Suffragette Revolutionary, and she joined me on the phone from London a bit earlier.
Oh, thank you very much, Geraldine. Pleasure to talk to you.
It made me think, dare I say, to strike a slightly light note, why we haven't seen Indian characters in Downton Abbey. Like emerging, because really, in a way, that's the world you cover.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, there's an enormous crossover, and it's spelt, you're quite right, Sophia, but it would have been styled at the time. She was born during the Victorian era, Sophia, which is how she was known for the rest of her life. But yeah, she certainly lived that kind of lifestyle. She had a wonderful house, Faraday House, which is where the famed scientist Faraday had lived before her, at Hampton Court Palace. She had servants, she had flunkies. She prided herself on having the best-dressed servants in London, who wore these extraordinary vivid maroon outfits with very shiny brass buttons with her monogram SDS on them. And that lifestyle really was, you know, a little Downton Abbey-esque.
And the point is she hobnobbed with the Downton Abbey types, didn't she?
The set, oh gosh, that was absolutely her set. I mean, for a period of her life, I would happily describe her as my worst nightmare. I mean, she was an it girl. She lived to go to parties. Her days revolved around the next invitation. It was easy to plot her progress during this period because there pretty much wasn't a party that she didn't attend. Mm. She was at the seasons. She travelled around wherever the royal family went. So, you know, she was very much part of that Downton set. You're absolutely right.
So let's just head back a little bit, though, to set the scene. And let's look briefly at the story of her grandfather, Ranjit Singh, the Lion of the Punjab, because this gives us a good understanding, I think, of the developments in the British Empire during this period, which became, I suppose, were the seedbed for her life.
Well, Ranjit Singh, if you say that name to anybody of Indian origin, particularly if they're from the north, he is a legend and more than a historical figure, the one-eyed king who from the age of 14 rode out into the north, a wild land, if you can imagine it, at that time, where Afghan tribals used to come over and harry the villages on the borders. And they were disparate fiefdoms and villages, and he united the whole of the north, building it into this extraordinarily rich and powerful kingdom, which the British could only watch and envy. There was no way when the British arrived in India that they could touch it. And the most famous thing that Ranjit Singh had in his Toshkana, which is the treasure house, was the Kohinoor diamond. Now, if you live in Britain or if you visit Britain, you can still come and see the Kohinoor at the Tower of London. It's a beautifully faceted diamond for hours and hours, that's right. But at the time when Ranjit Singh had it and he wore it strapped to his bicep, it was the size and heft of a hen's egg. It was uncut. It was massive. So this was a man who had untold wealth and had extraordinary power. The lion was never defeated in battle. And despite the curse that comes with that diamond, that says that any man who wears it or wields it shall be destroyed in ashes. He was a man who almost defied the supernatural and ended up dying peacefully in his sleep. He never lost the Kohinoor during his lifetime. But it all sort of went to hell in a handcart when his young infant son, Sophia's father, Dilip Singh, came to the throne.
Mm. And when did the Sikh's kingdom yield?
Well, it was actually in 1843 when, he came to the throne, Dilip Singh, in 1843. He was dethroned in 1849. And it was really down to the very clever machinations of the British during this time. They saw that this young boy, this puppet king that the Sikh The Sikh court actually thought they had a puppet king and they might be able to control him. They didn't reckon for his firebrand mother, who I like to think of as the first suffragette, Rani Jindal, who comes out of Purdah to rule with her small infant son. And the British start making deals with people in Dilip Singh's court after 1843. They start making deals saying, look, when the time is right, we want you to depose this boy and we'll give you a kingdom of your own. And sure enough, that is exactly what happens. 1849, he's forced to sign a treaty, giving over his kingdom, his future, and his family's future. Even the Kohinoor diamond is handed over to Queen Victoria's people.
And in fact, in England, he comes to England as an 11-year-old, and oh, 15 when he's exiled to England.
Yes,
and he
that's
becomes
right.
A rather exotic pet, really, for Queen Victoria, who called him her beautiful boy. And in fact, you've got pictures. He is a quite striking-looking young man, I must admit, but it sort of becomes rather pathetic, doesn't it?
Well, his story is full of tragedy, and he also, you know, creates tragedy around himself. So you imagine, you know, after the British come, they first of all, they drag his mother away and they imprison her in a tower. So he's alone. He has nobody to advise him. His father is dead. His mother is imprisoned. And he's put into the care of a Scottish couple until the age of 15, and he learns to behave like an Englishman. Then he comes to Britain, as you're quite right, at the age of 15, and he creates a sensation in the court, you know, dressed in his fine silks, dripping with diamonds and pearls, and with the favour, the intense favour of Queen Victoria, who does, I think, you know, have real love and affection for him. But he finds out through the years that follow that he hasn't actually been given all that much favour compared to other monarchs from India. He doesn't have that much. He has to keep begging the India Office to pay his bills. And it puts him on a collision course with the British government until the point where he decides he's going to take his kingdom back. And that is when everything implodes under his life, under his family's life. In fact, his daughter, Sophia, finds herself arrested for the first time at the age of 9 when her father is dragging the whole family across the waters in this failed attempt to get back to India to retake his throne. And they don't get further than Aden in Yemen, which
yes,
is very much in the news.
It's really, it's hard to read. I mean, he does, just so that we have a couple of names in place before we move on, finally,
sure,
to Sophia, but he does finally install his bride, the illegitimate daughter of an Abyssinian slave and a German
yes,
businessman, this amazing woman called Bamba, who also charms Queen Victoria, but who certainly doesn't have an easy life because the Maharaja takes to drinking heavily, has numerous affairs with showgirls and so on and so forth. So it's not easy, is it?
It's not easy at all. I mean, this young child, I mean, she's really a child bride if you think about it. Look at pictures. She looks younger than she even was at the time. She was 16 when the Maharaja's eye settled on her. He wanted a virginal bride who he could mould, but also who could be as much of an outsider in the British court as he was. And he finds this girl who speaks no English, has never gone beyond the cloistered walls of the mission in Cairo where she's been brought up, where she's been dumped by her father. She's illegitimate, as you quite rightly say, and her mother is a slave. And she comes to England, and from the moment she comes, apart from being almost constantly pregnant, she's constantly struggling with this reality that she has never experienced before. It makes her lonely. It makes her very sad. And then after this failed attempt by her husband, the Maharaja, Sophia's father, to take back his kingdom, he jettisons her. He jettisons her and the whole family, leaving them pretty much destitute back in London. And she also takes to drinking heavily. It's an alcoholism that will ultimately ruin her children's young lives and will take her life as well when Sophia is just 10 years old. So, I mean, it is just a miserable existence that the children and their mother go through after this failed attempt to take India.
Yes, it's certainly the inglorious side of the British Empire. BBC journalist Anita Ananda's my guest, and we're discussing her new book, Sophia, Princess, Suffragette and Revolutionary, and you're here with us on Saturday Extra on Radio National. So, the protagonist of your book, Sophia, is born into this insecure environment, but lives a luxurious life. So when does the transformation take place? I mean, when does she start to become a radical?
Well, I mean, Geraldine, it's almost like this is a woman who's lived four lives, to be honest. So she's born into luxury, as you say, before her father takes on the British Empire and loses. So, you know, when she's born, she lives in this Mughal palace that her father's created in the middle of the English countryside. She's got leopards penned under her bedroom. She has any number of servants waiting on her. But then everything, as I've just mentioned, goes to hell. She's destitute. She's so destitute that only Queen Victoria, her godmother, can save her. And after her mother dies, she's been described as feral. She has no confidence. She can't look people in the face. She's written off, actually, as being so debilitated by fear and loss, because she loses her mother, her youngest brother, and her father in quick succession, that she may be no good to society. But then she comes out. Queen Victoria sets her a date, saying, you will have your debut and you will have it at Buckingham Palace and you must meet the world. And she rises to it, turns into this nightmarish it girl of my worst nightmares. But it is actually a trip to India. She could have lived this fantastically pointless life, you know, swanning about parties, smoking her Turkish cigarettes, being in the society pages. But a trip to India, a forbidden trip to India at the turn of the century, changes all of that. Edward VII is coming to the throne. The Viceroy of India wants to throw this enormous celebration to welcome him, but also to teach the natives just exactly who is boss. They must all come and bow before their new King Emperor. And Sophia, who lives in London with all of these very rich Downton set, as we call them now, all of her friends are going and she's itching to go. So despite the prohibition, she and her two sisters, sneak into India. And when she gets there, she sees poverty like she's never seen before. Even though in London she is a celebrity and she's treated like a royal, in India she's just another brown-skinned native. They treat her no better than a coolie. So she comes back from that with this huge resentment, this huge anger. Suddenly the party is just not enough for her anymore. And she starts looking for causes, and it's the start of her philanthropy. But it's her second visit to India in 1907 that really does transform her, because then she falls in with the radicals, the nationalists in India, who are fighting the British. And that is her accelerated education, which changes her to, you know, there's somebody with a conscience finally,
yes, and
somebody who's willing to fight.
And it seems to have activated something remarkable, and which really centred on the suffragette cause back in the UK. I mean, I know it was also parallel with the notion of Indian independence. But I am intrigued as to how the royal family, particularly her sponsor, Victoria, reacted to Sophia's growing revolution. But by then it was George V, of course, I suppose.
That's right. Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, she lived through the reign of three monarchs. So Victoria never saw the rebel. Victoria died thinking that she'd set up her goddaughter and her goddaughter would
little
be
girl.
Fine. She'd be lovely. I mean, she was fine. She may never marry. That was always the fear in the British court, because who is going to take this heathen wife? Nobody, I mean, the horrible words of the day, wanted sort of mongrel children, as they put it. There are papers that I've quoted in the book which refer to the children of Duleep Singh as dusky tadpoles. So there was an enormous amount of racism. Men would dance with her, but they were never going to marry her. So then she is sort of lives through the reign of Edward VII. She goes to the Darbar. He also dies before he sees her turn into this harridan of Hampton Court, as the papers like to paint her. But George V got it full force in the neck, and he loathed her. He would constantly write furious letters every time she appeared in the newspapers, waving placards or being dragged into court for some other suffragette antic. He would get, in the words of his staff, apoplectic, and he would write letters to the India Office saying, can we not get her out of Hampton Court? The problem was, they said, yeah, if you want to, you can, but then you'll have to answer to the people and the press that you've turfed out your grandmother's ward. How do you want to deal with that? And of course, he'd always back away because the embarrassment was too huge. And that embarrassment factor saved her from prison. She tried so hard to get thrown into prison. She wanted nothing more than to go on hunger strike like her fellow suffragettes. So she would wade into battle in these riots. She would be arrested for being part of this cadre of women around Emmeline Pankhurst, who would sort of wallop out against the police while trying to make their points. But though they would arrest her, they would never charge her, because that embarrassment of having the princess, Queen Victoria's goddaughter, going on hunger strike in prison was just too much to bear. And in these sort of conflicts with the police, she clashed even with Winston Churchill. I mean, she really was right up there in society.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask you a final question to sort of, in a way, pull it together, because you've got this very interesting phrase, along with her five siblings, Sophia struggled from an early age to understand who she was, where she belonged, and what on earth she was supposed to do with her life. She had this sort of prestige and powerlessness all at once. You know, it is really quite a poignant example, isn't it, of somebody caught in a massively changing times and caught between societies. Is that what you took away from it?
I did. You know, it seemed as if her life was a map of the sort of geopolitical situation at the time. You know, you have this supposedly this, you know, glorious empire in India where, you know, the mythology was really Kiplingized. You know, it was sort of the benign empire doing well for the grateful natives, you know. But the reality underneath Scratch the Surface was something really very different. And likewise, you know, if you open the magazines at the time, you saw this wonderful, beautiful, well-dressed woman who seemed to have all the grace and favor in the world, but inside was imploding. These pressures of who was she? You know, she was too Indian to be English, too English to feel Indian. She was a princess, but she relied on handouts from the state that, you know, lived in fear that they could be withdrawn at any moment, and then defied them to withdraw these favors. And that defiance also maps that relationship between India and England, because India too started defying what seemed to be the most unassailable empire of modern times. You know, they rose up against the British, and no one would have believed maybe 20, 30 years before that such a thing would have been possible. So I'm just intrigued at how a personal life story can also be so entwined with and chime with the times in which she lived, and I found that completely absorbing.
Well, I'm glad you did. It took 4 years of your life, and I can see it all there. Anita, thank you very much indeed for joining us and telling us this remarkable story.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
BBC journalist and presenter Anita Anand, A-N-A-N-D, the author of Sophia, Princess Suffragette Revolutionary, published by Bloomsbury, and it's quite a read.